Santa Claus sitting in a sauna by the sea, many majestic modern museums, and fantastic filling food. All this can be yours when you choose Helsinki to host the 2017 World Science Fiction Convention. Where else can you enjoy 17 hours of sunlight while exploring an 18th century island sea fortress? The home of Angry Birds and Linux is calling. Come be a part of the excitement as you enjoy all of this and the World Science Fiction Convention in 2017. Make sure to vote Helsinki in 2017. For more information on how to help Helsinki host the World Science Fiction Convention, please visit www.helsinkiin2017.org.
Danger! The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Shoot the wisp, ex machina. Turing tests don't work that well in AI femme fatales.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Rachel.
And we're having a very special episode this week on Ex Machina, a very interesting film that Rachel wanted us to cover a while back when it was in theaters, but we kind of didn't have the schedule for it. And so we're now doing it, and it's honestly, I really wish we had done it several months ago, Rachel, but we didn't for reasons that now seem like completely inadequate reasons. But I did want to take a minute to kind of jump to you, Rachel, because you really pushed for us to do this. You thought we would love to do this film, and I agree, but I kind of wanted to get your take on why you really wanted us to watch it at the time.
I would also, I'm just going to start off with noting that the next time I tell you that a movie is really amazing and you need to go see it, listen to me.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Rachel.
So the reason I wanted to really get into this movie is because for a film that has a plot that can be stated very simply, there are so many layers to it, and the acting is just phenomenal, and there's just so many issues that you can just get in and dig into, and it's just there's so much meat to it, like, which is unusual when, you know, a lot of the sci-fi these days is kind of like tentpole effects blockbusters because, you know, generate your dinosaurs with computers or whatever. But when you get into a science fiction that is really looking at kind of issues of what it means to be human and technology and humanity and so, you know, social issues that don't necessarily have anything to do with technology directly, just you can get into so much cool stuff, and this movie really digs into things quite fearlessly.
Yeah.
And there's just so much there.
And I did think it was interesting that this film came out roughly around the same time as another film that dealt with AI called Chappie.
Yes.
Which I have not actually seen, but based on the reviews that I have seen, seems to be a far less rigorous film than Ex Machina.
There's actually, so this is the thing. I did see Chappie. I saw them one weekend after another. And Chappie, which I have a review that I never put on my website and I need to do that. So Chappie's problem is that it is a lot less focused than Ex Machina. But when you get to the end, basically the film, you know, after a bunch of like action-y stuff happens and all that, you get to the end of the film and that's when you suddenly get like the philosophical meat in about the last 20 minutes when it's kind of a little too late. But it's basically the director being like, yeah, you know what, dualism, that's bullshit. There's no such thing as souls. Everything is in your brainwaves, and you can copy it onto a robot.
Oh, well, and interesting.
Yeah, so you get to that last 20 minutes, and you're like, holy shit, what did I just see? This is amazing. But it takes you so long to get there.
Yeah, and with Ex Machina, we kind of get the payoff pretty quick. And so I think it'd be a good time for us to dive into the movie. So plot-wise, as Rachel said, it's a very simple movie. The basic premise is a notable programmer wins a corporate lotto for a fictional company called Blue Book, which is basically just Google.
Yeah, it's not Google.
It's not Google, but it is. It's essentially mimicking totally Google. But he wins the lotto to go spend a week with essentially the guy who invented Blue Book. And it's supposed to be sort of a big old deal. And when he gets there, he discovers that his boss has been working with AIs and wants to basically have him conduct a series of what he's referring to as a Turing test to determine whether or not the AI is actually sentient. And thus begins a very confusing, psychologically, I don't know, manipulating and just really like a deep like exploration of what it means, I guess, to be conscious, to be human, to be conscious, to be living through a sequence of increasingly disturbing moments. And
yes.
I think this is the point where I think it's going to be fair to say that we're just going to spoil a lot of this movie. So I'm not going to wait for us to put a spoiler wall up. We're just going to put that up now. If this is a movie that you really want to see, let me rephrase that. This is a movie that you really should see. And if you have not seen it,
yes,
and you get bothered by spoilers, stop now. Go watch it right away. It is $3 on like YouTube and all them places that do the rentals, Amazon, whatever. You can get it on a DVD at Netflix, or you can just go buy the DVD. And honestly, this is a film to own. And I think everyone on this, including Paul, would agree that this is a film to own. Correct, Paul?
I intend to buy it, yeah.
Nice.
This is a great film. So, spoiler walls up. We're going to... all kinds of stuff. It's just everything's going to happen right now. So, I want to start by kind of giving some general reactions, some thoughts, some things that we really want to explore. And I thought we'd start with you, Rachel, since this is essentially your movie. And we'll start with one of the meaty things you'd like to explore.
Okay, at some point I want to get into the stuff that is particularly disturbing from the viewpoint of a woman, but I don't want to start there.
Fair enough.
The thing that I want to start as kind of like the topic is there is this amazing exchange that Caleb and the AI Ava have, and Ava asks Caleb during one of the sessions, "What will happen to me if I fail your test? Will I be switched off?" And Caleb says, "It's not up to me." And her answer is, "Why is it up to anyone?"
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was just like, that moment, I was like, oh my God, this movie just punched me in the spleen. Like,
And this is, I think, comes in the third session with Ava?
I want to say it's like the third or fourth. It's pretty early on.
It's pretty early on, and it's after... He and her, Caleb and Ava have already had their discussion about decisions, right? He wants her to paint or draw something that she wants to draw, and then she kind of throws that back at him, makes a quote-unquote joke, right, about, you know, he needs to decide what they need to do and these kinds of things. And so it comes about from this moment of decisions where that's kind of become a central point, right? How do you test an AI? Well, you have to give it the ability to make its own parameters. And then we get that moment, right, where she's actually considering her existence, right, and the idea that she might have rights to anything at all. And it is quite, I think, shocking, that moment, because I think even if we're admitting that she's more robot and that she's not actually intelligent, that should chill us, because the idea is she's going to be shut off and killed, essentially. It's going to be murder.
That kind of eternal question of what right does someone have to take another person's life? Because obviously Ava's on Team Ava of I am a person.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it gets even creepier once Caleb starts finding the old ones. That Ava is hardly the first one that the billionaire has created, and there's a whole series of them. And he's gone through a whole mess of iterations, and we see him messing around with the laptop, and when we see the bodies, it's like, yeah, he's going to shut Ava off if she doesn't measure up to whatever to his standards, and that's creepy.
Well, and of course, the standards that he's set don't appear to be the standards that he's actually holding her to. Because what he says to Caleb is, you're here to do the Turing test to decide whether or not she's conscious. But it's pretty clear, I think, that even though he never tells us explicitly what his standards are, they're not just simply the Turing test. It's something even more. He's expecting something far more than Ava probably can even offer to him, because I don't think that he just wants a sentient machine. He wants something more insidious.
Well, I think the character of Nathan is just fascinating and disturbing. I've described him as sort of a real world imagining of someone, of what someone with Tony Stark's intelligence and resources would actually be like, because I doubt they would be a giant, you know, like a superhero if they had that kind and ego. Because you see, like, so much of what Nathan does is being driven by his ego. And remember, he keeps, like, misquoting Caleb over and over again and just, like, not even listening to Caleb whenever Caleb's like, hey, I didn't say that. When he's like, yeah, because you said you're not a man, you're a god. So you can tell what he's plainly doing is being like, he's a god and Ava is his creation. And I think he even implies very heavily that, yeah, he's totally just going to shut her off and erase her and start a newer, even better one.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes on about like how he's controlled every aspect of her being like a god. I mean, it's super, super creepy.
He is. And I always got the impression pretty early on that he was creepy. And not just an eccentric billionaire, but that he was full-on creeper pretty early. But the degree to which he is creepy, as that's unveiled to us, is... it gets pretty disturbing. And I know some of that, Rachel, you don't want to talk about yet, and so we'll have to bring up some of that later, right? And Paul's already kind of mentioned it, the stuff with the bodies, etc. But, I mean, I think about halfway through the film, I mean, we shouldn't be on the side of Nathan in any sense. We should think of him as the villain. But I think what's weird about this film is that Caleb is also not the good guy.
Well,
in a weird
this
way.
This is what I think, though. I mean, the film is kind of nice in one that is that there aren't any archetypal heroes in it. You know, Nathan is probably the closest we've got to a real villain because he is super fucking creepy for a myriad of reasons. But then you have Ava, who hoodwinks not only Caleb, but through him, Nathan, but also the audience, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she manipulates everybody. So, to a certain extent, it kind of forces you to ask that question of, like, well, if she is a sentient person, how far is someone allowed to go, and what are they allowed to do morally to preserve their own life and escape unfair imprisonment, because she is basically Nathan's prisoner. So, I mean, there's that whole thing with Ava. And then Caleb is neither hero nor villain, because he is basically just there to be the pawn for Nathan and Ava. And all they do is play him off, you know, just play him back and forth and try to gain advantages and use him like a tool. And Ava ultimately wins because Nathan has created something that is better at manipulating people than he is. Because you see Nathan being super manipulative all the time, but he does it in a very clumsy way. Like, you know, the misquoting Caleb thing, or he keeps telling Caleb, like, you know, this is what you're thinking. You know, he does it in a sort of, like, force of personality, I'm going to steamroller you kind of way, because he's in a position of power, and, you know, probably you could also put that down to him being a guy in a position of power. And then Ava seems helpless.
She's
and
subtle.
Yeah, so she has to be very subtle. So, I mean, it's very interesting.
Yep. So I did have my tagline at the beginning. I called her a femme fatale, and I really think, and I really wish David was here, because I think he and I could really discuss it. I really think that in the noir sense, Ava is a femme fatale. So, I mean, she's trying to manipulate Caleb and Nathan. And Nathan's trying to manipulate Caleb, and Caleb is the pawn between those two. And like in classic femme fatale fashion, Caleb is, I mean, it's like Double Indemnity. Caleb's the poor sap in this, and he's getting pushed by her to do what she wants, and she wants freedom. And Nathan's pushing Caleb and lying to him. And it's basically, as you said, Rachel, it's kind of a chess match between the two of them, between Nathan and Ava, with Caleb as the poor piece that gets exchanged back and forth across the board all the time.
Yeah, but and of course, I think it's really important that Ava happens to have the tools to better manipulate him.
Because there's and Nathan gave them to her, which is the even more interesting part. Nathan designed her to be heterosexual female, and we're told that she was designed for Caleb's preferences.
Yeah, designed but for Caleb's preferences. Designed with the ability to read Caleb's expressions on a level he can't even fathom, right? That the discussion of micro expressions.
Well, it's not just Caleb. She can read Nathan too.
Yeah, she can read Nathan too. So it's really her being able to read people in general.
Right.
And there's that creepy moment where Nathan, near the end, right? Nathan basically has quote unquote caught Caleb, right? In the act of trying to free Ava. And exposes to Caleb that he has been following Caleb's search history, including by the question that Caleb gives us, right? He's been watching what he looks for in porn and has used that as the basis for Ava's appearance. As a kind of composite of his porn interests, which is super creepy, but... Also, it's like, were we expecting anything else other than Nathan? I mean, the guy required him to sign an NDA notice that basically said you submit to full surveillance.
Yeah, well, I mean, that there's one thing I also wanted to point out is this gets into like this heavy element of voyeurism.
Yeah, there's a lot of voyeurs in this movie.
Oh yeah. Well, and Nathan is the prime one where, you know, there's even parts where he's like sitting around without a shirt on, watching TV monitors, and you're just like, this is like, you know, all it needs right now is like a dick and then it's porn. Like that's how creepy it is. But then he also tries to make Caleb complicit and does make Caleb complicit in this very abusive voyeurism of Ava. And then in the voyeurism that Nathan has practiced upon him, and so it's so creepy.
Yeah,
I mean, go ahead.
Ava in particular, right, is sort of one of the main central pieces that is being watched. I mean, that moment when Caleb realizes that he can watch Ava from his room,
mm-hmm.
and then his response is "What the fuck," but he doesn't turn it off. He keeps clicking through, seeing the other cameras.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this. There's a sort of creepy underbelly there of the kind of, it's something that Rachel, I know you mentioned we're going to eventually get into in more depth, but it's certainly the kind of position of female bodies as being watched on so many levels. This movie is about female bodies being watched, observed, controlled, etc.
Or even just privacy observing and watching. I mean, Caleb's being watched all the time. He's getting to watch Ava. Then we have Ava doing the power manipulations to try to give them privacy, but it's a false sense of privacy because Nathan installs a battery operated camera. It's so there's you can even say this movie has things to say about the surveillance state and companies watching us and us watching each other and that whole voyeuristic attitude of is there any privacy in this world anymore?
Yeah, there's that great line that Nathan says about. You know that what the search history tells us is not what people search for, but how they search, right? And it's very clear, even when he reveals how he got information about Caleb, right? It was how he got Ava to be able to do the facial expressions was basically to hack the entire cell network, right? In a way that, and he even says, right, like, I hacked it, and the cell companies knew I was doing it, but they won't do anything because they will have to admit that they had the same ability and were doing it themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the surveillance state is maybe not the central focus, but it is that.
No, it's just another layer in this movie.
It is another layer, but it's that kind of creepy side of it, because, I mean, look what you can do with data. right, that we all have in our phones, and the idea that anybody could possibly access it and use it for any reason is a bit disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I kind of...
I was going to say, one thing I wanted to touch on really quick, since we were just talking about the way that Nathan and Ava basically use Caleb as a pawn, and, you know, and... It's kind of nice because he gets to have a little gotcha moment at the end when he's kind of, you know, I almost felt like when he kind of does his gotcha on Nathan, he should just be like, I have something to tell you. I am not left-handed, you know, like his one big reveal. But for the most part, I ended up just feeling I felt a lot of pity for Caleb because he spends the entire time just in over his head. He's getting bounced back and forth by two people who are just completely subjugating his personality. He's not a particularly strong person, even though he does try to do what's right, and then he gets fucked for it at the end. But then there's that moment where, and I think it's after he finds out, you know, Nathan's creepy dead robot women in the closet, and he goes into his bathroom and he cuts himself. Oh, he's trying to see if he's still a person.
I loved that scene. I mean, it was disturbing, but it made perfect sense because Nathan would be the kind of person who would create an AI and have them think they were doing the normal thing and then realize that he wasn't even... When I saw that scene, I was thinking, okay... This movie could go either way. I was thinking, yeah, I could see circus underneath that. That would be okay. I was like, see, is he real or not? Okay, blood, he's real. But the movie had just a good point building up to this point and discussing the ideas of AI that I would have been okay with either reveal. I think the movie could have worked and gone in very different directions, but I was okay with that. That was a genuine fork that the movie made that where the stakes could have gone either way and it was plausible for it to have gone either way.
I will say that I appreciated that it did not make him a robot. I like that it kept that because it sets up a bunch of expectations, and this film does this a bunch of times, right? It gives us, is it Kyoko?
Yeah.
The silent woman who turns out to be one of Nathan's androids, and it's very clear, I think, pretty early on that she is most likely to be an android. I think it becomes clear, like, the more we see her, the more we realize there's something not quite right. But even with Caleb's character, the further in we get, right, the more I think we're led to the expectation that he would be not real. We have the clues about his life, right? His parents died when he was young in a car accident. His most recent memory is not even a full memory. It's a set of sounds and colors. We have all of these things that kind of limit his humanity. And so when we get to that moment, there's an expectation that the reveal is, oh my gosh, he's an android. Oh my God. But then he's not. And then I think that makes what's happening even more impactful. That what he's seeing is actually an intelligence that is making him question his own existence to a point of self-destruction almost.
Yeah.
And I think that scene is really hard for me to watch. I can't watch people cut themselves.
Yeah.
But it is a tense moment because this is that moment where, like, we can see the ball of yarn in his head unraveling, right, as he's starting to really wonder, like, what am I? You know, if Ava is a real person, if she is capable of love and thought and all of these things, what is it that makes me human? That is there. And this film does present us a couple moments of pretty brutal violence. Even the violence against the androids is, I think, just as graphic as the violence that happens against human bodies. If not worse, in some cases.
I actually, what really struck me about the violence that Nathan enacts upon the robots is that I think we have this idea of how robots should actually be very kind of tough, because I think, you know, we think like Lost in Space and mm-hmm. you know, Mr. Data and all that, and we're like, they're made out of metal. But to a certain extent, you know, computers are surprised. You know, if you take a computer and you drop it, it's probably not going to be doing that great when you pick it back up. But the other thing to consider is that after we've been told over and over again that Nathan exercised godlike choice in creating these people, you know, because at this point I am thoroughly convinced that they are people, he chose to make them so delicate that he could destroy them with his bare hands.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought. Because you're right. I will disagree with you slightly in that I don't think all of the androids he creates are fully sentient creatures. Because some of them seem almost vegetative. But I think, because like we see that scene, right, where Caleb is looking back through the history of the androids. And some of the androids, like, they can't even sit up for periods of time.
I'm mostly thinking about Ava and Kyoko.
Yeah. Ava and Kyoko, I think, are Ava, for sure, I think we're led to think that Kyoko is, because she makes a decision in the end, although we don't have as much evidence available to us as we do of Ava, precisely because what Nathan does to Kyoko, which is he essentially makes her silent and sort of subject to his whims.
And yet there's the scene after he scolds her. She's like off in the corner and we see a scene. It's almost like she's almost crying. So she's got emotions, thoughts. I mean, they're locked up because she can't speak, but it doesn't take voice to be human.
No, it doesn't. I think what I'm saying is that with Ava, the problem, and this is, I'm getting into stuff that I know Rachel's going to want to talk about, so maybe we should just dive into it. But with Ava,
yeah, let's just go, because we keep dancing around it.
There's so much stuff to talk about with how this film deals with gender, but I'm just going to say one little thing, and then we can kind of do more things. But like with Ava, the problem Nathan has is that he can't control her. He tries, but the only methods he has of control for her seem to be violence. He's even losing control of his own facility to her. Right. And as we noted earlier, right, Ava is, if not as good as, then certainly better at manipulation than Nathan. As you said, Rachel, right, Nathan is a very kind of gung-ho, in-your-face kind of manipulation. In some cases, it's very obvious that that's what he's doing, and Caleb catches on to it a number of times. With Ava, he doesn't catch on until it's beyond too late. He doesn't catch on until he's locked in that room.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the moment I think he really catches on to what's happening. But with her, it's Nathan's only response is violence, because her sentience is so enacted that he it's about control and he can't control her. With Kyoko, he can control her, which is why I say that while I think it is true that she probably is sentient, that it is hard for us to get that from the film, precisely because whatever Nathan has done to her, he has achieved what appears to be full control over her body in such a way that she not only doesn't speak, it's unclear to me whether she can or cannot speak. She can certainly listen, and can certainly take orders. She can't speak. Her interactions with others are muted. I mean, she doesn't quite demonstrate emotion. She demonstrates something approaching awareness. And so what I'm saying is that I'm not saying that she's not sentient. I'm saying that in Nathan's interactions with the female androids around him, are about two different coins of absolute abuse. One in which he can't control Ava. He can't take away her personhood, and one where he has almost completely removed personhood. And which is why that moment at the end of the film, when both Kyoko and Ava kill Nathan with a knife, right, is I think very significant, because it's not only the abused female figure, right, the kind of character who is incapable of action, taking action, finally breaking out of that, but also the sort of the female character who has agency taking action, them together, like in solidarity, essentially wiping out the violent masculinity.
The thing with Kyoko is honestly what she put me in mind of was, say, a woman who has been, you know, stuck in a religious cult.
Yeah, super abused. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, that's so, you know, I don't know if it's just my viewpoint, but I actually never questioned Kyoko's sentience.
Hmm.
Because I basically just read her as someone who has been imprisoned and abused for so long. When I still thought Kyoko was human, because I thought she was human for a while, I kind of went, oh my God, she's like a mail order bride.
That was my first thought. Like, okay, she's Japanese from overseas. And I mean, it's a couple scenes. I flipped over completely at the dance scene. When she and Nathan dance, and she's like, she's dancing kind of jerkily. She's a AI too, of course! Duh!
I will say that I was never convinced that she was full-blood human. I was always, the first time she shows up where she walks in complete and utter silence and then walks out without so much as emoting anything, that to me, that raised all of my suspicions that she was an AI, an android. I thought from the start she was.
And it's interesting because...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, because like I said, I just was like, oh, you know, she's basically Nathan's mail order bride. And if she doesn't give him exactly what he wants, then, you know, she's going to get shipped back home, or he's going to beat the crap out of her, or who knows.
Right.
Like,
and I think that is the sort of metaphor being played with, for sure, that that's what he's created. Which is, I think, even more insidious than the idea that Nathan would have, like, ordered a woman from across the sea in order to basically be his, like, servant. No, he's going to create a fully sentient being to be his servant.
Well, in a way, I mean, if you think about it, you know, there's stories about women, you know, like the human slave trade, sex slave trade, and just the regular... That still occurs in a very underground fashion, that a lot of it is kind of like mail order bride stuff. So if you think about it, technically speaking, someone who gets brought in to a country in that way, if it can have at least at the basic recourse of law enforcement, where they might end up getting deported back home, and who knows, it might actually be worse than what's happening. But there is still that acknowledgement that there could be someone out there who could save them. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you have Nathan creating Kyoko as, like, you know, mail order bride part 7, where there are absolutely no human ties, and if INS busted into his house tomorrow, he'd be like, she's not even a person. You can't do shit to me.
Yeah, which raises the question, what is the end game for him? Why is he trying to create sexualized, sentient female robots?
Oh, why is he trying to create AIs at all? I think my...
It's God complex.
Well, yeah, God complex is certainly it, yeah.
Basically, he wants a form of immortality, not to mention, and then this movie is full of interesting philosophical and scientific conversations. They talk about AI and the singularity. Nathan believes the singularity is inevitable. So if the singularity is going to come no matter what we do, then by getting there first and creating the first AI, that's essentially putting your stamp on what's to follow. I mean, it's going to evolve out of all recognition at some point, but you got there first. You were the one who did it. I did it. I mean, granted, you'll probably be dead or gone or what have you, but you can go to your afterlife with the knowledge that, okay, I made that happen. I was the one who did it. Yes, it was inevitable. I made it happen. I pushed the button. That's the God complex talking again.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's the God complex thing that is what pushed him to make the AI, and I think what pushed them, you know, the impression I get, what pushed him to make the AI female and sexualized and explicitly heterosexual is the fact that he can control them in a way that he would never be able to control an actual human woman. Because again, there is no way for them to escape him. He is the god of their little universe, quite literally.
Yeah, and in a way, this film, I mean, I don't know if it was intended for them to do this, but I mean, the if you look at the history of sex bots now, I mean, they're rising and rising. I mean, they're obviously, we don't have sentient sex bots, right? But they're becoming more and more complex, and in a very sort of different direction. This comes to the kind of dark underbelly that could exist in a culture of sex bots, because let's face it, I mean, just a robot that has that mimics sex is not going to be enough, right? We're going to be increasingly moving towards fully sentient like beings, and that, and yet the closer you get to sentience, the less ethical the act of controlling that body becomes. And here, right, we have sentient beings whose bodies are forfeit to, in both cases, men. And I think that's what's really significant about the ending, is that Ava and Kyoko both kill Nathan, who's sort of the toxic masculinity. I mean, we see that throughout, right? He is this the manly man who does manly acts all the time. He exerts his masculinity in very violent ways. And so when he's dying, it's sort of them killing off toxic masculinity, but they also kill off any possibility of relinquishing control over their agency to another man, which is why I see why Ava locks Caleb up in that room, presumably to die, because yeah. He will have control over her in not the same way as Nathan per se, but it would still be a form of control. This way, control is entirely her own. She owns herself, right? And when we see her in the end, right, she's standing in that that lane with the people walking around her, and it's her in full control over her own body, which would not have been the case, at least perhaps for Ava's perspective, with Caleb, who would have been able to exert some kind of force over her.
Well, if nothing else, Caleb would know that she is not actually human. And so eventually, you know, I'm sure you can see a scenario where he'd be like, well, you're not actually human, so I can switch you off, or I can do these other things to you, or, you know, I'm going to tell other people. So, yeah, you're right. The only recourse she had was in escaping and making certain that no one ever could ever know. And that, like, I mean, the ending of this movie, I was just like, oh, God, poor kid. To a certain extent, poor Caleb, because he finally managed to pull his one cool moment of beating Nathan, who, you know, was the classic, like, toxic masculinity, victimizing women, but also victimizing other men. But then he kind of, you know, just because he knows too much, and Ava has absolutely zero reason to trust any human.
Yeah,
he has to go.
And yeah. I do think it's really interesting that as you remark, right, he sets up this whole thing where he's going to be the savior. He's saving the damsel in distress.
Yep, white knight.
She's not a damsel.
Yep.
She's not a damsel, and he doesn't know it. He's been tricked. Like, he's had the trope used against him.
And
and I'm sure she saw that in him and used it wholly.
Yeah, yeah, she saw it from the start. Yeah.
Yep, and consider the fate she gives him is the fate that they were going to give Nathan originally. That's what they were going to do, to lock him in so they couldn't get out. So kind of almost fitting, like, okay, I'm gonna lock away what would bind me and hold me.
And, well, to a certain extent, I actually kind of wonder if that's a statement from Ava that basically says, you are the same as him.
Ooh.
Oh, that's
cold.
Dark. That's a very dark feminist interpretation of, like, all men are scum. I mean, Caleb is a pawn. He gets pushed around. He's a chump. He gets his one win over Nathan, and then, yeah, because he's just as much, he's not as big a threat as Nathan. He's not as a creator, but he's a threat. And as you said, Sean, she has no reason to trust any human. She's been designed and lived in this room. Why should she trust Caleb at all? Why?
Yeah, there isn't much reason, and I do kind of agree with you, Rachel, that it is her killing off male control altogether, because Caleb will have control over her body.
Yep.
Whether or not he exerts it doesn't matter. He will have control. And it's control that she doesn't have a choice, which I think is really important here in the end, that this film makes a big deal. Like, I think in session three with Ava, right, the idea of choice, of decision comes up. And yet it is her decision, right, in the end, that she will have full control over her own body. What happens to it, how, what she's going to do with it, whatever, that no one else will ever have the ability to control her body. I think that's what's happening in that moment. That's the statement she's making. It's my body. That's it. And nobody will be in a position to have any control over it.
Yeah. I mean, because you can look at it from the feminist angle, particularly since it's so specifically a woman pitted against these two men. And then when you take a step back, you can still even just look at it as that question of what will a person do in order to survive and ensure their freedom when they have been raised in captivity and that when they are a prisoner? And you know, you can look at it from that aspect as well, because Nathan was her jailer, but Caleb was probably going to be like, you know, jailer part two, the slightly nicer one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that's a real question that comes up is what is Caleb's end goal? He gets her out, but then what? They go on a date? What, like, yeah. Is that what's going to really happen? I mean, let's be honest. That's not what's going to happen.
Well, and the power differential is so imbalanced between them.
Yeah.
Like, I think probably in Caleb's mind, he is thinking like, oh, you know, well, like, she'll be like, you know, I'll have saved her and maybe there will be a thing and then I will show AI to the, you know, who, God knows what his end game was. I don't honestly think that Caleb was thinking that far ahead.
That's possibly true. But from Ava's perspective, she doesn't have the option, right?
She can't.
Oh, yeah.
She can't trust them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, she can't, right? He's only there for 7 days. I mean, let's be honest.
The one human she's ever interacted with has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that humans are fuckers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what reason does she have to believe that Caleb is any different? I mean, after all, Caleb is just as willing to backstab his own people.
True.
So, yeah. I mean, her interactions with people are pretty much screwy. She's got no, I mean, and it makes total sense why she makes the act she does. Because what other act was she going to do?
Yeah, nothing else would have made sense.
Nothing else makes sense. She's like going to hand Caleb a bunch of wildflowers and says, let's go dance in a field. No, she's going to do what she can to preserve herself, to protect herself. And that means doing the acts that she has learned by osmosis, by watching people around her doing horrible things. And that's her recourse, is just...
It's a very much angrier version of... You guys have both seen Next Generation, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of The Measure of a Man.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
For those listeners who don't know, Measure of a Man was a Star Trek Next Generation episode where Data gets put on trial to basically prove he's sentient and not just something the Federation can just take apart and do as he likes.
Oh, right,
as they like.
Yeah, by Melinda Snodgrass.
By Melinda Snodgrass.
Yeah, Snodgrass is good.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, what would Data have been like if he had been raised in the most fucked up environment imaginable?
Right. I think that you wind up with Lore.
Is that his evil twin?
That's the evil twin. Dr. Soong had raised Lore poorly, and we wind up with the malevolent AI who treats humans very poorly, and he learned better for Data, but Lore.
Was it that Lore was raised badly, or I thought there was like he had emotions and Data didn't, or something?
He had emotions.
Lore was not programmed and raised very well.
No, but that's because Dr. Sin is kind of crazy.
Yes, I mean he did better with Data, but Lore was his. And then of course we're not going to mention the Star Trek movie with the clone of Picard and the earlier version of Data.
Insurrection?
No.
Nemesis. God. And we have
Tom Hardy.
So that completely blows this whole plot. So it doesn't exist. So I'm not going to talk about it.
Well, but then there's Generations, right, where he plays with that emotion chip. And I think what's really significant for Data, and what is in such stark contrast to what's happening with Ava, is that Data throughout Next Generation is surrounded by people who support him in his decisions. Right, like they make
who are constantly
him.
Telling him that he is a person, and
right.
I mean, not initially. In the very first couple episodes, I think there's a question. Right, even Picard is questioning, like, how much of a person is Data. But as they go along, right, it's very clear that that's they view him as a person. I mean, like, Data's relationship with Geordi, right, is one that is a very very supportive relationship. I mean, Geordi may question, like, why would you want to do X. And Data would say, well, I want to do that. And Geordi would say, well, fine, but be careful. And that's the end of it. Right? It's that kind of friendship you'd expect. But that's something that Ava distinctly lacks. She has no interactions with other people, even other robot people.
Right.
That are positive. Her only interactions with Kyoko are her speaking to Kyoko, her giving orders to Kyoko. But as far as we know, Kyoko never speaks. So we don't know. I mean, it's possible they speak to the computers, but the story never gives us that, right? So her only interactions with other people are, in fact, a man who very well is going to dismantle her, or at least erase her memory, right? Essentially killing her, and who is abusive and violent, and which she has evidence of that he is all of those things, or a man who doesn't even believe initially that she is a person, and is testing her very existence, which are two different forms of not being supportive whatsoever. She has no support at all. And the result is what we see, right? We see essentially a feral sentient being, a being whose only recourse is to destroy the very things that are trying to destroy her. It's survival of the fittest, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, she basically does what she has to do in order to survive, which, to a certain extent, is another indication that she is a living creature in her own right. I mean, see, this is why I wanted you to see this movie. Oh my God, there's so much here. It's like, ugh.
But that concluding scene, I mean, if you're ever in doubt about whether or not she was sentient, that she was conscious, that she was capable of, like, that she was basically human but in a robot body, that moment when she makes all the decisions at the end, that should have been the moment where we go, yeah, she is. She's a person.
See, I would argue with you. She is not basically human in a robot body. She is an AI.
Right, but I'm sorry. That's
which
a
is not
framing.
The same as being humans. I mean, she sorry. Is a life form that
an
is
artificial life
conscious.
Form.
Well, she is a life form that is conscious but different from us.
Right. That's fair. That's fair. Sorry, I shouldn't have said human. I should have said conscious and sentient artificial
yeah.
being. That's what I meant. Right, but if we ever question it, I think that moment solidified that she in fact is.
Oh yeah.
If we didn't already think so, I think we all come to the conclusion that she is an artificial intelligence. If not,
oh, yeah.
the first time he tells us about her, then certainly a couple sessions in that she certainly is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I probably would have fallen for all of Ava's tricks.
Oh, totally.
Oh, totally.
I mean, if nothing else, you know, she was just like, "I will use your empathy against you." Sad little meat bag. The only thing about the movie that I actually didn't like is, I mean, I understand why they wanted to end with her at the crosswalk doing what she said she would, you know, what she told Caleb she would do if she got out.
Yeah.
But to be honest, where I wanted it to end was literally when she just walks out and goes into the elevator and then has that little smile and the door's closed. That's where I would have ended it.
So you don't think we needed the helicopter or anything else?
Nah, I think it just needed to be her being like, bye, bitch, I'm out.
Yeah, it gives a much more insidious view, whereas when we get the helicopter scene and then her in the street, it is...
It softens the ending a little.
It does soften it a lot.
That darkness. Which, so here is where I would disagree, and I think that the intent here is we're supposed to actually sympathize with Ava.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes very difficult when Ava becomes villain and remains villain. So when we end, as you say, Rachel, like on her giving that smile, I think if we get that smile in that moment, it makes it an insidious smile. It doesn't make it the smile that we get, which is, I think we see her smile and then we see her kind of run up those stairs, right? That yeah. smile we get is kind of joy a bit, right? The idea, I'm free. I get to run out into the world. If we end just on the smile, I think that what we get is like, I fucking killed you bitches. And that's what's get, yeah, you know what I mean?
And, yeah, no, I get it.
However, I think it's just as interesting. It's just, I think that depends on what the intent is. And I think that the intent here was we're supposed to sympathize with Ava. However, if we wanted to create like the horror zone, right, where AI turns total freaking evil, then yeah, I think your way may that
where
was
she goes all Terminator.
She essentially goes Terminator. Yeah. But again, I don't know what the intent is. Maybe I thought the intent was that we were supposed to sympathize with Ava, even though she commits murder in the end and essentially commits double murder. But maybe the intent was actually that moment we see with Caleb where he's like just standing on the other side of that room watching her put on the skin. And he is so terrified. He doesn't even know what has happened, right? I'm assuming he thinks Nathan's dead. But he's watching her basically put on her person suit and go out, like, walk away. And you can see in his face, he is terrified. It's sort of that confrontation with, you know, the singularity, right? The moment of our irrelevancy, which the film does bring up at one point,
yeah.
right? That they'll,
yeah.
Nathan brings it up that they will take over, essentially. We will become, like, he says, we'll become like the fossilized bones we find in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, right? Just a bunch of old, dusty bones of like, worthless beings that have been dead for centuries, right? Upright apes is what he says.
Which kind of reminds me a little bit of the end of the movie AI.
Oh, interesting.
Because in the end of the movie AI, now we're spoiling movie AI. I mean, we have the boy robot sleeping underneath New York for a couple thousand years, but when he's woken up, all that's left are the robots. They look kind of like aliens, and when I first saw the movie, I thought, they're aliens? And it took me a moment to realize, no, they're robots too, duh! And yeah, the robots, yeah, man's died out and the robots have taken over. Singularity has happened.
Yeah. AI is a really underappreciated film.
It's got its problems, and I'm not so happy with some of that last bit with the whole bringing back the mom thing. I mean, in some ways, I think the movie could have ended pretty well just with him buried underneath the water and end it there. But yes, AI, I think, is a pretty underrated movie these days.
Well, we are at, I mean, we've
oh my God.
Hit a lot of stuff. And I think now may be a good time to grade this film with our very last thoughts and send everyone on their way. Sound good?
Sure.
Okay, go, Rachel.
All right, Rachel, you're up first.
All right, A+. Would recommend. I mean, this is basically some of the best science fiction film, like very thoughtful science fiction film, has come out of British independent film recently, and this is like continuing the trend. We all bow to our masters from the United Kingdom.
fair enough, Rachel. All right, Paul.
Yeah, this is one of the best science fiction films in the last 10 years, if not longer. It was amazingly good. I'm gonna have to give it an A+. I know I'm not gonna. I know I sometimes overgrade films. So I don't think I'm overgrading this one.
It needs an A++.
Yeah, technically we're undergrading if we give this an A+. There needs to be a new grade, like the ultimate.
It should just be like the letter scale and then Ex Machina. Like, I'll give it an Ex Machina minus if it's almost that good.
So its original release was this year, right?
Yes.
So it is Hugo eligible for next year's ballot.
Premiered.
I'm going to check.
Okay. Yeah. Rachel will check while I babble.
Because this thing's got to go on my Hugo ballot next year for sure.
Well, I would be honestly, like, this year's been really good for sci-fi films. So if It Follows, Ex Machina, and Mad Max are not on the Hugo ballot next year, I think we can all just say that the Hugos are irrelevant and should be burned to the ground forever.
Well, let's see. So it opened in the U.S. on April 10th, 2015.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, it should be eligible. It may have had a
okay,
premiere.
UK release date. The earliest release date was 21st January, 2015.
So yeah! All right.
But it was an indie film, right?
Yeah, it's an indie film.
When does it say its premiere was? Because it may have premiered at a film fair in the previous year.
You mean a film festival?
A film festival.
Well, I mean, there was a film festival in Sweden on January 30th. I mean, the earliest release date is literally the UK release date on January 21st.
That's probably... It probably qualifies, and if it was at some obscure film festival, then whatever.
Yeah. According to Wikipedia, the official release date was January 21st.
So then it's good. It's nominated.
It's going on my ballot for sure. If it's not going on my ballot, then we've got some other kick-ass movies that kicked it off, which would be a good thing, but I don't see it being knocked off because it's that good, people.
Well, there may be reasons, Paul.
Well, I'm saying my ballot. I'm not saying the final ballot.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I should be obvious. I'm giving it an A+. I think this may be... to be fair, it's July... But this may be the best film of the year.
It is a little bit early days,
but we are past the midway point, so it's getting very unlikely that this will be pushed down. Is it better than
Mad Max? I'd have to think hard on that.
Something challenging the supremacy of Mad Max is a hard sell, but yeah, I mean, I would actually put this one like just a little above Mad Max, even though Mad Max.
And they both challenge the patriarchy. How do you like
they
that?
They do, yes. And I think that's great. In fact, all three of my top films for this entire year in some way deal with gender issues, because even It Follows deals with this kind of stuff in terms of female bodies and sexuality. I mean, it takes a very different sort of very dark take, but it does deal with those issues. And honestly, these films have been some of the most compelling. I mean, this year feels a lot better than last year in terms of the compelling film side of things. In terms of the blockbusters, not so much, because we got Jurassic Turd and
Avengers 2.
Age of Ultra Pants.
I liked Ultron okay, but yeah, Jurassic World was not... I mean, you know, blockbuster-wise, the one that I think will probably save blockbusters from complete irrelevancy is going to end up being The Martian.
I don't think that's going to be a big blockbuster, though.
It's got Matt Damon.
But I mean, it's not going to be a $1.5 billion movie. I'm thinking in terms of, like, last year, our big blockbuster films... Right.
I think it'll end up being up there with like Interstellar, you know.
Maybe.
Interstellar did pretty good.
Interstellar was good. Yeah. But in any case, sorry, we're kind of rambling on about other stuff and maybe we need to cut it out. So basically, we all give it an A+ and we all think that you should watch it if you have not seen this film. It is by far one of the most compelling films I've seen. And I agree with Paul, in the last 10 years, if not longer. It's good.
Seriously, it's worth the $3 for the rental. Do it. Do
absolutely.
It
so, on that note, folks, we're going to close out. If you'd like to support our show, we did just open up a Patreon page. We're at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. All kinds of nifty cool bits in there, little reward levels. We got some milestone goals, including one that I'm really excited about, which is that we were hoping to do translated interviews with non-English speaking authors.
Woo!
But we kind of need money to do that, so... supporting the show will help us reach that goal when we can start to do more of that stuff. Or you can just give us $1 because you love us.
You should totally give us $1 because you love us. Because Sean's cute.
I am cute. Thank you.
You are.
Okay. So thanks everyone for joining us. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
See, next time I tell you to see a movie, see the movie.
I will. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I
heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.